go ahead and take a seat, counsel. Each of you has 15 minutes for presentation of your case in chief. 5 minutes is reserved for rebuttal to appellant counsel if you choose to utilize that. Please remember to state your name as well as the client you're speaking on behalf of when you begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Phil Kaplan from the Anthony Oslin Law Firm on behalf of appellants Joaquin Galindo Martinez and Consuegro. And with me today is my partner, Art Boylan. The district court abused its discretion in this case when it denied appellant's Rule 19 motion to dismiss CHS's complaint. This court should reverse. One of the primary purposes of Rule 19 is to protect non-parties who could be harmed if the case proceeds without them. Rule 19 requires all necessary parties to be joined at the outset of a case. And if a non-party who is a necessary party cannot be joined, and if in equity and good conscience the case cannot proceed without that non-party, then the case should be dismissed. On the face of CHS's complaint here, Gradesa is a necessary and indispensable party, and Gradesa hasn't been joined. When you look at the allegations in the complaint, CHS claims—
to acknowledge that he can't be joined because he's not a citizen of this country, right? I mean, you acknowledge he can't be joined.
We are not aware of any facts that would allow CHS to join Gradesa to this case, correct? It's possible that there's some sort of jurisdiction. We just don't know that. So for the purposes of this appeal, I think we have to acknowledge that Gradesa cannot be joined.
Mr. Kaplan, is there anything that prevents Gradesa from accepting jurisdiction?
Gradesa could accept jurisdiction if they wanted to.
Part of the reason I ask is that it looks like much of the appellant's argument is speaking for them and all the adverse results. And it struck me that you should pass that information on to them and accept jurisdiction. And doesn't that resolve the matter?
It doesn't. And the reason is the whole purpose of Rule 19 is to protect those non-parties who can't be joined. If a non-party could resolve this problem by simply joining the case, then there'd be no reason to have Rule 19. And in this case, it's especially important to not assume that Gradesa could join the case and defend itself, because Gradesa is a Mexican corporation located in Mexico. I don't know if they have any contacts in the United States. And from my own dealings with Gradesa's lawyers, they're all Spanish-speaking individuals. It would be a lot simpler and a lot fairer to Gradesa if this whole case was moved to Mexico, where Gradesa and appellants could all be joined in one lawsuit and CHS could make all of its claims there. It's not fair to Gradesa to assume that they can resolve any potential prejudice by coming to the United States and joining this case to defend itself. If they could do that, then Rule 19 would basically be turned on its head.
Counsel, the respondent is seeking money damages against your client for the breach of the duty of loyalty. Is that correct?
Correct.
They're not seeking return of payments from Gradesa.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
They're not seeking return of payments from Gradesa.
From Gradesa.
Gradesa, excuse me.
You know, I think it's a distinction without a difference. They're seeking damages from appellants for the amount of payments that CHS paid to Gradesa. And in order to get there, in order to recover those damages, they're going to have to prove that Gradesa engaged in some sort of misconduct, that Gradesa falsely charged CHS for services that Gradesa allegedly did not provide. And that's really the crux of the problem here, is that Gradesa's conduct is on trial. CHS is accusing Gradesa of some sort of fraud or theft when Gradesa is not here to defend itself.
Well, and why don't we look at 1902? Do you want to tell us how those factors impact your client?
Yes, Your Honor. So I'd like to focus on a few of the factors. I'm not going to address every single one. I think we've briefed all of them. Mm-hmm. But first factor is the judgment might be prejudicial to the non-party. And I want to emphasize the word might there. In 19.02, it says might. In 19.01, it similarly says may. So we're talking in terms of possibility. We're not talking in terms of a definite outcome that will absolutely harm the non-party. And in this case, a judgment in this case that Gradesa overcharged or falsely charged CHS would harm Gradesa at least from a practical matter. Now, I'm aware that CHS has said they won't bind Gradesa to that decision from a res judicata or claim preclusion theory. But even if they're not bound by the decision, it would still be persuasive precedent. CHS can wave that decision around and say, look, a courtroom or a court or a jury in Minnesota came out with a well-reasoned, well-thought-out opinion that Gradesa engaged in theft and stole money from CHS. So even if another court is not bound by that, you should still follow it because it's a well-reasoned opinion. CHS could also use that decision as evidence of misconduct by Gradesa. And CHS could use that decision for settlement leverage. Say, look, there's additional damages that we can seek from you out here. A Minnesota court or a Minnesota jury has already decided that you took millions of dollars from us by defrauding us. We're going to use that against you unless you pay up. So there's lots of reasons here that Gradesa might be prejudiced by the outcome in this case if it goes CHS's way. Factor B, the prejudice can be lessened by protective measures in the judgment. And again, I touched on this a moment ago, but CHS has said on the record that they will not bind Gradesa from a res judicata standpoint to a decision in this case. But that doesn't resolve those other practical problems that I just mentioned: settlement leverage, persuasive precedent, bad evidence against Gradesa.
Arguably, though, the prejudice can be lessened or avoided under B, can it not, by shaping the requested relief?
It could be. But from our perspective, the only way to truly mitigate the prejudice to Gradesa would be to remove any claims and any allegations that Gradesa engaged in misconduct. And CHS hasn't indicated any willingness to do that. And it would take a central piece of their damages theory away from the case. So I can understand why they don't want to do that.
Mr. Kaplan, but if I understand correctly, it's the employee, it's the conduct of the employee, or I assume former employee at this stage, in dealing with Gradesa. And so it's the deficiency, in other words, by not having them there, at least on its face, CHS has accepted that limitation, but they're really focusing on the employee's conduct in dealing with Gradesa. And so I'm not understanding how that directly implicates Gradesa. And you said, well, we just disagree with that, but they have to show that the employee conducted himself inappropriately towards Gradesa and any other parties to the opposite or the harmful result to the plaintiff.
Correct.
Understanding how that, even in a kind of a long way around, obviously they're going to have to prove that, and if they don't, they lose. And
yes, they're going to have to prove that Mr. Galindo and his company, Consuegro, engaged in a breach of fiduciary duty. They will have to prove that.
So what part of the complaint are you claiming is pertinent as far as Gradesa is concerned?
There's several allegations, Your Honor. As to the alleged overcharges by Gradesa, there's paragraph 10 of the complaint, paragraph 28, paragraph 31, paragraph 37, and paragraph 42. And if I may...
But CHS isn't seeking any monetary relief from Gradesa?
Not directly from Gradesa, no. They're seeking the amount of payments that they paid to Gradesa as damages against appellants. And to finish my answer to Your Honor's question, there's, I think, two pieces to CHS's claim. One is a breach of loyalty by Mr. Galindo and Consuegro. The other piece is, underlying that, they're going to have to prove that Gradesa engaged in misconduct, that they falsely charged CHS for at least part of their claims. So in paragraph 10, CHS alleges, through this action, CHS seeks to recover damages that it suffered as a result of Mr. Galindo's disloyal conduct, including payments to Gradesa that Mr. Galindo helped to orchestrate, which were not for bona fide services rendered. So that part of their claim, which is strewn throughout their allegations, depends on a finding that Gradesa falsely charged CHS. So it's not only Galindo's conduct or not only Consuegro's conduct that's at issue here. Gradesa's conduct is at issue here too. They're basically accusing Gradesa of theft So Gradessa should be in the case to defend itself if we're going to be arguing about Gradessa's conduct.
Could some of those issues, I think it was raised earlier by the chief judge, be limited by the court's in limine orders and other limitations on evidence as it gets to that point, as opposed to what the employee conduct was and limiting it to minimize any harm to that non-party, or at least that's not relevant to what the employee did?
Right, and theoretically the court could limit the relief in order to avoid prejudice to Gradessa, but that would require the court to deny any damages or deny any claims that implicate Gradessa's individual conduct.
Can't that be done through the special jury verdicts that are received?
Potentially, yes. But again, we haven't heard any indication from CHS that they're willing to withdraw those types of claims or damages theories, and that's not what the court decided. The court didn't decide to limit CHS's claims that way. The last factor under Rule 19.02 that I wanted to address was the plaintiff will have an adequate remedy if the case is dismissed. And here, CHS does have an adequate remedy. They could start a new lawsuit in Mexico that joins appellants and Gradessa all together. And here's where a couple of the many abuses of discretion came up in the district court's orders. First, the district court erroneously decided that personal jurisdiction over appellants is questionable at best in Mexico. And that's at the addendum, page 10. But the district court didn't provide any explanation for that, and that conclusion is directly contrary to the record. Mr. Galindo is a part-time resident, at least part-time resident, in Mexico, and Consuegro is a Mexican corporation. So Mexico clearly has personal jurisdiction over appellants. And on top of that, if that weren't enough, appellants concede that they're subject to personal jurisdiction in Mexico. So that was one abuse, that the court said that there is no personal jurisdiction in Mexico. Another related abuse is that the district court erroneously assumed that CHS could not assert its Minnesota causes of action in Mexico. The court ignored law that says Mexico has authorization, or Mexican courts are authorized to apply foreign law. And in this case, appellants will stipulate to the application of Minnesota law to appellants, CHS's claims against appellants, even if we're in Mexico. So there is nothing preventing, no jurisdictional bar, no substantive bar, preventing CHS from suing appellants and Gradessa in one lawsuit in Mexico so that all these allegations can be wrapped into one and Gradessa can be free to defend itself against those allegations and not depend on appellants to try to defend Gradessa's actions here in a separate court.
Mr. Kaplan, you've been focusing on the 1902, and I noticed the judge, trial judge, did the same thing. Is it your understanding the parties essentially agree, or the court at least found it was so obvious that it did not need to address the 1901?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can answer what the court was thinking there. I think the court had decided that Gradessa can't be joined, and because the court decided that Rule 1902 wasn't satisfied anyway, that it didn't need to address Rule 1901.
Does your client believe that clearly the party's necessary, and then that's why you've been focusing on the 1902 today as well?
Yes, that and a lot of the factors overlap. So in Rule 19.01B, it says that a non-party is necessary if they claim an interest in the action and they're so situated that their absence as a practical matter may impair or impede their ability to protect that interest, which to me parallels Rule 19.02A, which says that the judgment might be prejudicial to that non-party. So essentially for the same reasons we believe 19.02 has been satisfied, we believe 19.01 has been satisfied as well. I have about a minute here, and in closing, I want to just make a couple of comments. One is that one of the problems here with the district court's order is that the district court reviewed certain issues in isolation rather than looking at the big picture here. There are a number of circumstances that make this case unique compared to some of the cases that CHS has cited and even compared to some of the cases that we've cited. Why it's imperative that Gradessa is found to be a necessary and indispensable party here. And those factors are CHS accuses Gradessa of misconduct in this case. CHS's claims depend, at least in part, in significant part, on a finding that Gradessa has engaged in misconduct. CHS seeks damages for payments that it made to Gradessa. Gradessa and appellants are alleged to be closely affiliated from a corporate standpoint in this case. Gradessa and appellants are all subject to jurisdiction in Mexico, and Gradessa and CHS are already suing each other in Mexico and have been for the last 3 years. So for those reasons, Your Honor, we believe that the district court should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaplan.
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Michael Duffy. I'm with Mr. Brian Dillon, who's my local counsel, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellee respondent, CHS. The central question posed by my client's lawsuit is whether, as a Minnesota company, it can sue its former employee who is a Minnesota resident on a theory that he violated Minnesota fiduciary duty law. I don't think that there's any question that whether a duty between Mr. Galindo on the one hand and my client on the other can be resolved without anyone else being present in the lawsuit. And that's the essence of our case, that whether a duty of loyalty, candor, and disclosure was violated can exist and can be litigated fully to verdict without Gradessa. And I think that that's the critical question here. And if you look at the determination of whether a party is necessary, you can have complete relief without the presence of Gradessa. Now, I concede, and I think it's clear from our complaint, that Gradessa is at least a factual corollary to our complaint, for sure. But we are not seeking any damages from Gradessa. We are not seeking to adjudicate any of Gradessa's rights. And to the extent that there is an allegation about fraudulent charges made by Gradessa, that is just one part of our complaint. The underlying theory is that the appellant had a duty to disclose his relationship with a supplier to my client. He did not. And whether that disclosure was made and whether he benefited from that lack of candor and self-dealing is the central question.
Would Mr. Duffy, would your client be able to succeed without demonstrating wrongful conduct by Gradessa to the jury?
Yes, yes.
And how do you do that if they're, as you said, integrally part of?
I think if you look at the allegations of the complaint, take, for example, the duty of disclosure, which is, I think, a key part of the duty of loyalty. Mr. Galindo was obligated under Minnesota law to act on his principal's behalf, my client. And the fact that he had engaged in numerous investments undisclosed to my client with our supplier is a per se violation of the duty of loyalty. Based just upon that failure to disclose and his actions in commingling his assets and benefiting from partnerships with this third party, that in and of itself is a recoverable breach. And to the extent that monies went to his business partner that he brokered, I think an argument can be made whether or not Gradessa acted or knew about his breach. An argument can and should, and I think under the law, you know, would succeed, that it was a breach of the duty of loyalty. So if you
look... what about your opponent's argument as to the prejudice to Gradessa?
I actually think that, first of all, the prejudice, if it exists at all, is not considerable and should not tilt the balance for a couple of reasons. The first is the central question is on Mr. Galindo's duty. Did Mr. Galindo violate his duty? Gradessa had no duty, at least under a fiduciary context, to my client whatsoever. So to the extent that Gradessa's conduct is at issue, it relates to charges that Mr. Galindo brokered. And if there is a determination by the court related to this small part of our case that Gradessa fabricated charges, we've agreed that we will not use whatever determination in any Mexican court, even assuming we could. And I think that's a critical point here about prejudice. And it bleeds into the argument of the appellant throughout. The idea that just based upon an article that we could bring a fiduciary claim grounded in Minnesota law in Mexico is totally without support. And also the idea that a litigation between my client and Gradesa in Mexico, which is totally unrelated to fiduciary duties, would somehow benefit economies or would be a remedy that's adequate to my client is also totally without support. It's just not there. The fact of the matter is a Minnesota court sitting, it has perfect and I think general jurisdiction to hear a claim grounded in Minnesota law, and there's really no disputing that. The cases we cite, I think in particular, are apposite. If you look at the Cummins case and at the Halsney case, all of those deal with situations where there is a third party, in some cases a foreign third party, who isn't present. And because it is in the employer context, the employer-employee context, or the fiduciary context, that's the distinction, is that here there is a question of duty. And whether the duty exists and whether it is violated can be litigated and adjudicated completely without Gradesa. Now, I think Judge Slider made an excellent point. We have accepted the limitations that we cannot implead Gradesa. We may not even be able to get discovery from Gradesa. And I disagree with the assertion that it is questionable whether jurisdiction can be had. We agree with that. We accept that burden. And we're intending to litigate the discrete issue of the duty of our employee. That's why duties exist. He owed us a heightened burden, and he violated it. And that is a question solely under Minnesota law. In terms of the idea or the notion that a remedy couldn't be fashioned that would limit prejudice, the onus on Judge Frisch was not to do that in the motion to dismiss. That's not the standard. The question is, can a remedy be fashioned that could limit prejudice to the non-present third party? And clearly the concessions of appellate counsel indicates that at some point in the future there can. I have conceded, and I will made a binding admission on the record, that my client will not seek to enforce, even if we could, by the way, and I don't think we can, any factual finding with respect to Gradesa in any court. The court can fashion additional prophylaxes to limit any potential prejudice to this third party, one of which, for example, is the binding admission. Separately, if the court wished, we can sever the allegations about Gradesa's fraudulent charges. I don't think we need to do that at this juncture. I think it's a part of our case that can be proven even without any finding as to Gradesa. It could very well be, by the way, that Mr. Galindo, and we are at the pleading stage, that Mr. Galindo himself, without the knowledge of Gradesa, created these factual, these factually inaccurate charges. I mean, this is the issue here, and this I think comes to the point about prejudice. It's entirely speculative. The idea that at some point in the future I might use a heretofore unknown factual finding in an unknown cause of action in an unknown jurisdiction under a theory in Mexico that is unknown against a third party is not a basis under the well-reasoned authorities to dismiss a case grounded in Minnesota law against a Minnesota defendant by a Minnesota plaintiff. And that is, I think, what is the fundamental difference here. And I think that is the final point I wish to make, is that to the extent that the appellants are arguing that there should be reversal, it really is almost on a de novo theory. They cannot cite a single controlling case that has been violated by the lower court. And that is the abuse of discretion standard. It is unsupported by law or fact. And there's plenty of fact here in which to ground Judge Frisch's opinion. And she was well within her discretion to make the findings of fact, and there is no citation to controlling authority that has been made. The fact of the matter is she was within her discretion, given the authorities, which we believe are in our strong favor, to make the findings both of fact and law that she did. And the fact of the matter is we are here under an abuse of discretion standard.
Mr. Duffy, do you believe that, and you referenced the possible severance or litigation differences as a result, do you agree the judge has the authority as a result, assuming the decision is affirmed, to police the prejudice throughout the trial, whether it's discovery, but most importantly in the presentation of evidence to grant motions directly related to this was an example of the prejudice if this evidence is allowed to proceed with Gradesa and the judge can reconsider her ruling and police that through the trial to minimize the prejudice to Gradesa as the case unfolds?
I do. And I think that you saw a preview of that when Her Honor asked me on the record, you know, to clarify any doubt whether I would use any hypothetical decision prophylactically in a hypothetical court. And I said yes. So there can be all sorts of measures that can put in place that limit the prejudice here. But the essence of the crux of our case is, if you cannot try a Minnesota cause of action grounded exclusively in Minnesota law between Minnesota parties in Minnesota, then this is an absurd result. And, you know, there is no record evidence whatsoever that a Mexican court would accept my pleading or even, frankly, the concessions that appellant's counsel has made here today. At the end of the day, the relationship between an employee and an employer and a fiduciary is different. And that's why we filed suit against Mr. Galindo. Is the law creates heightened expectations, both of candor, disclosure, and loyalty. And we're entitled to litigate those in the forum where Mr. Galindo was employed. So if there are no further questions from the court, we'll rely on our briefs.
Thank you.
Thank you for your consideration.
Just a few brief comments here. My opposing counsel said that we haven't cited any cases that the district court's ruling violated. There are four cases that I would encourage this court to read because they really parallel the analysis that this court should engage in, and they are the most analogous cases that we can find that are in the Eighth Circuit or in the state of Minnesota. And those are the Two Shields versus Wilkinson case. It's an Eighth Circuit decision. Omega Demolition versus the Hayes Group, Polanco versus H.B. Fuller Company, and Do Ye Enterprises versus Advantech. All of those are cited in our briefs, so I won't get into the citations right now. But I encourage the court to read those four cases closely. Opposing counsel said that it's entirely speculative how CHS might use an adverse ruling in this case against Gradesa. We don't think it is speculative at all. Gradesa and CHS have been involved in hotly contested litigation, including criminal actions, in Mexico for almost 3 years. They are fighting each other tooth and nail. They are seeking millions of dollars from each other. It is not hard to see how a ruling in this case accusing Gradesa of theft could be used by CHS against Gradesa in a subsequent action or in settlement negotiations. Third point I want to make, opposing counsel said that there's merely an article that suggests that a Mexican court could apply Minnesota law to this case, and that article isn't enough to support the theory that CHS could bring this case in Mexico. That article was written by a Baker McKenzie partner, a Baker McKenzie partner that represents CHS in its lawsuit against Gradesa in Mexico. So I think we can take CHS's attorney's words for it that a Mexican court can apply foreign courts law. In addition to that, as I said, appellants would stipulate to the application of Minnesota law. And with that stipulation, I don't see how a Mexican court would deny the application of Minnesota law. The last point I want to make is that opposing counsel is correct. This is an abuse of discretion standard that the court should apply. But that doesn't mean that the court should just rubber stamp the district court's opinion. We aren't arguing in our briefs about facts where there's evidence on both sides and the court needed to weigh the evidence and make a factual determination. And we're not talking about a situation where there's multiple factors that weigh both ways and the court had the authority to weigh those factors. In our brief, we are talking about errors of law, and we're talking about areas where the district court completely ignored or contradicted CHS's own allegations in the complaint or ignored or contradicted undisputed facts in the record, including the very existence of this Mexican litigation that's already going on between CHS and Gradesa. Unless your honors have any further questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Thank you, Mr. Duffy.